Today, one of the lights of my life, Maggie, is going to light our chalice. Our chalice lighting today is from Jennifer Kitchen. Come, sit by our fire and let us tell stories. Let me hear your tales of far-off lands, wanderer, and I will tell you of my travels. I share your experience with the holy with me, worshiper, and I will tell you what I find divine. Come and stay, lover of leaving, for ours is no caravan of despair but of hope. We would hear your stories of grief and sorrow as readily as those of joy and laughter. For there is a time and a place and a hearing for all the stories of this world. Stories are the breath and the word of the spirit of life, and that power we name love. Come, for our fire is warm and we have seats for all. Come again and yet again, come speak to me of what fills your heart, what engages your mind, and what resides in your soul. Come. Let us worship together. All right, here's my message for all ages. It's a video. We'll see how this all rolls. So today I have a video that when I first saw it, I really think it explains at a level everyone can understand a great way to start comforting someone that's had a loss. The person that did this research studies big losses, and she'll speak to that in this video. But I want to remind you that everyone has, there's many different levels of loss, right? If you have a friend at school that lost their favorite stuffed animal or a pet rabbit, this video will also give you good ideas to help with that. So guys, I want you to think about a time when you were sad. I can remember when I was a child, I grew out of my favorite pink party dress. This was not any boring dress. This was the most fantastic pink party dress. And I loved it more than I can explain. It was a hand-me-down from a more frivolous cousin who had a whole bunch of pink party dresses. Easter season came and I pulled out that dress and it didn't fit. And it seems silly to me now, looking back, but I can remember. It was such a big loss. I can remember what the box looked like. I can remember where I was in the room. And my mom, right away, saying, oh, you've had plenty of other dresses. You've grown out of so many other dresses. We can find a new one. And yeah, it was all true. But now, going through 44 years of life, I realize it would have helped a little bit more as if my mom had just said first, oh, Cece, I know how much you love that dress. Think of all the fun memories you made in it. And just let me be sad about it for a little bit. Now, I'm not going to say I didn't want to go out and buy a new dress after finding out that one didn't fit. But I think that one step, that little step in between, would have gone a lot farther than we give that credit for, the acknowledgement piece. I often think of something my dad would say when I had a bad day. He would say, tomorrow will be different. I can't guarantee it will be better, but it will be different, and we can hope it'll be a better day. But he always let me be sad for when I was sad. Let yourself be sad. Let yourself miss that awesome pink dress. And then, when you're ready, give yourself a chance maybe to find an amazing blue dress that you can make great new memories in. Our reading today is Ring Theory Helps Us Bring Comfort In by Alana Sandler. A few years ago, psychologist Susan Silk and her friend Barry Goldman wrote about a concept they called the Ring Theory. It's a theory to help yourself know what to do in a crisis. If the crisis is happening to you, you're in the center of the ring. If the crisis is not happening to you, you're in one of the outer circles. Here are the basic tenets, paraphrased from Silk and Goldman. Draw a circle. In that circle, write the name of the person at the center of the crisis. Now, draw a larger circle around the first one. In this ring, put the name of the person closest to the crisis. In each larger ring, put the next closest people. As Silk and Goldman state, parents and children before more distant relatives, intimate friends in smaller rings, less intimate friends in larger ones. When you are done, you have a kvetching order. Here are the rules. The person in the center ring can say anything she wants to anyone, anywhere. She can kvetch and complain and whine and moan to the heavens and say, life is unfair. Why me? That's the one payoff for being in the center ring. Everyone else can say those things too, but only to people in larger rings. When you're talking to the person in the ring smaller than yours, someone closer to the center of the crisis, the goal is to help. Listening is often more helpful than talking. But if you're going to open your mouth, first ask yourself if what you're about to say is likely to provide comfort and support. If it isn't, don't say it. For example, don't give advice. People who are suffering from trauma, they don't need advice. They need comfort and support. So say, "I'm sorry," or "this must really be hard for you," or "can I bring you a pot roast?" Don't say, "you should hear what happened to me," or "here's what I would do if I were you," and don't say, "this is really bringing me down." If you want to scream or cry or complain, if you want to tell someone how shocked you are or how icky you feel, or whine about how it reminds you of all the terrible things that have happened to you lately, that's fine. It's perfectly normal response. Just do it to someone in a bigger ring. Comfort in, dump out. In the time since I originally read their piece, I have thought of this theory many, many times. Where am I in the circle? Given that position, what should I say? Or what can I hope would be said to me? Who are the people in the circle I could comfort? Who can I dump to? And I wanted to come up with a list of the practical things that can be done for someone in crisis. Here's a start. Bring a meal. Bring a cup of coffee, tea, or a chocolate bar. Offer to go for a walk. Offer to watch, spend time with kids, older parents, or pets. Come over just to wash their dishes or do laundry. Bring by your favorite CD or a movie. And if going in person seems like too much, send a note by mail. What do you have to add to that list? What's been helpful for you or a loved one? Where are you in that circle now? Here ends the reading. Now, for those of you that used to attend service when Tom was here, he always told us a little funny story to make us give money. So I wanted to channel him a little bit today. I have a story to share. Two men were marooned on an island. One man paced back and forth and worried, and he was scared, while the other man sat back and he was sunning himself. The first man said, "Aren't you afraid we're about to die?" And the second said, "No, I make $10,000 a week and I tithe faithfully to my church. It's stewardship month. My pastor will find me." We will now gratefully take the offering and maybe think of an amount that will send Cindy looking for you. I want to take you back to that last time you shared something that you would deem awful. A family member dying, maybe you broke a bone, illness, job loss, with a friend. Now think about what they said. I'm going to take a wild guess from some experience here that it went something like this. "Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss." Pause for dramatic effect. "Oh my God, I had something exactly like that happen to me, and let me tell you all about it." Did it make you feel comforted? I bet you, it didn't. I've managed to become a bit of an expert in dealing with grief. If it hasn't happened to you yet, you're going to lose someone close to you, and you're going to be knocked down by grief, or someone you love will be. And when that happens, we really, as a society, are horrible at dealing with it. Like you saw in that video I showed, the one thing we really need when we're grieving is acknowledgement and presence. We're taught to bring the lasagnas, to go to the wake and the funeral, give hugs, send sympathy cards and flowers, and some of us don't even manage to do that. It's too sad, we don't want to go to the funeral. But then we think our job is done. And I'm here to tell you that it isn't. I always feel like everybody knows my story because my losses, I feel like they're just like another limb, an extension of myself. But I'm going to share it now and get comfortable because we're going to go on a bit of a journey here. ready? My whole life, I knew I wanted to be a mom. Yeah, I went to school for economics, and yes, I was striving for a successful career. But, and I'm sure other Virgos in this room had similar life plans, I was going to graduate college at 21, get a great job right out of college, married by 23, house by 24, kids by 25. So you're really surprised that it didn't work out like that, right? I had some failed relationships, a career misstep or two, being in technology in 2001, that was a treat. But finally, I met the love of my life, Aaron, at 25. We got married, we bought our house, and then we're going to start our family. which, as most other things, I assumed we would follow the rules, do what we're supposed to do, have kids. And this is when I learned that not everyone gets pregnant exactly when they want to, and as a matter of fact, I probably wasted a lot of money on birth control. But after a few years, we did get pregnant. I remember attending a friend's baby shower and being so excited that I was also pregnant, but it was way too early to share with anyone. The joy I felt when it seemed like I was finally over the waiting, I remember I just felt it. You know, you really feel joy, like in your bones, you're so excited. Only to find out a few weeks later that it was an ectopic pregnancy. And this grief, it was intense. But we kept it close to our chest. And, of course, the minute I found out I was pregnant, again, Virgo, type A, I read that book, What to Expect When You're Expecting. And the last chapter is all the bad things that can happen when you get pregnant. You know, ectopic pregnancy, miscarriage, sudden infant death syndrome. I just skimmed that because it wasn't going to happen to me. Well, I should have probably read that one a little bit harder when I was reading there. So the doctors told us to wait a year to try again, so we did. And then we got pregnant, and then we had a miscarriage. And at this point, I started to feel doomed. It was a really dark time. I knew how much Aaron wanted to have kids. It was bad. I remember we went out to a party, and at the end of the party, I was like, you should just find somebody else, you know, just go find another wife. It's not working. I was grieving really hard. And this is when I thought, I really wish I knew about this ring theory before. Because the amount of people that shared their horrific miscarriage stories, I can't even count. And yes, I'll admit that it helped a little bit to know that a lot of people have had miscarriages more than I thought, and I wasn't alone. But it was a lot to be dealing with my own grief and then feeling like I needed to comfort all these poor people telling me about their own pregnancy losses. But then I found out I was pregnant with Cameron, and it was a wonderful pregnancy. But right towards the end, Aaron's father had a massive stroke. He was only 60 years old and my husband's best friend. So here we are with a much-wanted newborn and a very sick father-in-law. It was a pretty intense time already. But then in the middle of it, I was like, oh, I feel funny. And we were here. I don't know if you guys have been to a naming ceremony, but you stand up with your baby and they say nice things and we say nice things and we're supporting our community and everything. And I'm like sobbing, like hysterically sobbing. And I was like, what is wrong with me? I was like, the last time I felt like this, I was, all right, pregnant. And I was like, oh my God, there's a slim chance I'm pregnant. And then I found out I was pregnant again. And the next day I took a pregnancy test. We confirmed it. And I remember showing Aaron the test while he was changing Cameron's diaper, and he was like, congratulations. And then we didn't talk about it for like a day. We just like, okay. But then we went to the doctor. They confirmed it with a blood test. We had a ultrasound, and it was the same doctor that delivered Cameron 3 months before. And Aaron's looking at the screen, and he goes, what does it mean that there's two dots? And that he just, the doctor very quietly said, because it's twins. I was like, so then we proceeded to alternately freak out, be excited, and frantically prepare to have three kids under the age of one. I remember people asking things like, were you trying for twins? Yeah, we had sex twice at night. And then, of course, I'm carrying around a newborn, right? He's like 3 months old, and if you have twins, you show really soon. So they're like, how many kids are you trying to have? And I would joke. I would say, we really only wanted two. The reactions were priceless. I called my mom, and when I told her we were pregnant with twins, she just kept repeating, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. I'm like, Mom, you're not helping. You're not helping. And Aaron's grandmother, who's one of the most wonderful women I know, she said, if anyone can handle this, you too can. And if we only knew how true that was. I delivered Maggie and Nora at 38 weeks. They were big, healthy babies. Maggie was 6 pounds, 10 ounces, and Nora was over 7. We had them during that big H1N1 flu outbreak in 2009, so they didn't really let anybody come visit them. And I don't know if it was a sixth sense I had, but I just spent, I feel like it was 5 days, it's all a blur, in the hospital, just holding them and enjoying being waited on with nurses. Aaron was home with Cameron. I didn't even let him stay. I was like, I'm fine. I'm here. We took them home, and that first night, We're like, okay, here's what we'll do. Well, you take the first baby that wakes up, and then I'll take the next one, and then Cameron. And I don't think either of us slept all night because somebody was up at some point, every single point of that night. So the next night, we're like, okay, we need a better plan. So we put Cameron down, who was the reason we're pregnant again. He slept like a baby. A good baby. And Aaron was playing video games or watching TV with the girls right next to him. And he waited, and Maggie woke up. He gave her a bottle and then got her all settled. And this is the moment when I can say that my entire worldview changed. My new year zero. When everything in my life reset and my outlook changed. I relived the moment that I heard Aaron scream my name and run up the stairs, giving her CPR, calling 911, running across my front yard in bare feet and almost throwing Nora at the ambulance driver, praying they could do what I wasn't able to, letting Aaron get in that ambulance with my baby, knowing I couldn't leave the other two home alone, but not knowing, you know, what to do next. I needed to go to her, but I also needed someone here so I could leave, and then calling people, having people come, neighbors, waking up Maggie, to make sure she was okay, but trying to be quiet so Cam would stay sleeping, calling my aunt to come drive me to the hospital, because I knew deep down she had passed, packing drinks and tissues and taking my time, because the longer it took to get to the hospital, the longer I could wait to hear the actual news. But then getting there and being shocked and repeating no over and over and over, because I couldn't believe it was true, and holding her in my arms for as long as I could before I realized I had to leave. And then going home, where a policeman was waiting to question me, where I realized that I ran across my front yard in bare feet with two big dogs and I didn't step in dog shit. And then it hit me that I had posted on Facebook before I went to bed that day that today was the last day I would have three babies under the age of one. Not because I knew one would die, but because when Cam woke up in the morning, it was his first birthday. And this, my friends, is what I'm here to share with you. This is when, at the age of 34, I learned more than I ever wanted to about grief. That what really matters is that people are there. My best friends basically moved in for weeks. They made the call to family members to tell them that Nora had died. The minister came over and sat. He helped us navigate this insane world where I was burying my daughter, my much-wanted, anticipated, and loved daughter. They made sure we ate. Some families stayed with Maggie in the hospital because they admitted her for observation. Friends brought a neti pot, and I can't tell you how sore your nasal patches would get when you cry for like 3 weeks straight. Neti pots are great. Some other friends came over to have cake with Cam on his birthday so he'd still have to get his special day. They stepped up. I knew who really cared about and for me because they were there. Acknowledgement matters. I recently watched a video, I don't know if you guys have seen it, between Stephen Colbert and Anderson Cooper, where they talk about loss. Anderson Cooper just recently lost his mother. It's a quick 10-minute segment. I highly recommend you Google it, you know, say Stephen Colbert, Anderson Cooper, grief, and it'll pop up. Stephen Colbert has a very strong faith that helped him get through the loss of his father and two brothers when he was 10 years old. And many of the things that he said really resonated with me. But the one that hit home for me is when he said, "Love the thing I wish most had not happened." And then he quoted Tolkien, because you know how he's a nerd about that, right? What punishment of God are not gifts? And yeah, that sounds insane. How can I even say that the death of my daughter is a gift? Well, what I can tell you is that it helped me focus my life. Stephen Colbert, in that same interview, said, "It's a gift to exist, and with existence comes suffering." As a Unitarian Universalist, I feel this quote comes up in many of the religious traditions that we study. But for me, more importantly, I know that life is a gift. And guess what? You can't pick and choose what parts of life you want to experience. You have to experience all of it. And going through my losses has helped me make me aware that everyone is suffering to some extent. Maybe they haven't lost a child, but everyone has lost something. A dear friend, a job, they've had to move away from a community that they loved deeply and felt comfortable in, a beloved pet, maybe a relationship ended, or maybe that amazing pink party dress. When I was going through my fertility treatments, a word that was thrown around a lot was the pain Olympics. Sure, I may have trouble conceiving, but I knew I could get pregnant, so it's not that bad. Or I had a baby die, so no one could talk to me about their troubles. Or, yeah, I had a baby die, but that wasn't as bad as the person who had a child die from an overdose. Listen, folks, guess what? We all have things that happen that make us sad. Everyone in this world is suffering. And as humans, we need to be there and experience it with each other and know that we can depend on each other to be present for each other. I wish I could tell you now that my world is rainbows and sparkles and unicorns. Well, not all the time. But the other day, we were driving in the car where, you know, most good parenting conversations happen. And Maggie asked me, "Mom, do you have any regrets?" I thought about it. And I answered, I like to think this is a good one too. I have things I wish didn't happen, but I don't have regrets. And I don't. I've become the person that's standing in front of you today through all of my mistakes, losses, and joys. A twin pregnancy is risky, and we had a couple times when we saw issues with Nora in utero, but they were ruled out after additional testing. Do I wish I knew I was going to lose Nora after 5 days? Do I wish I never had Nora? Do I wish I never had to go through the loss of a child? I certainly wish Nora hadn't died. But even though she was only here with us for 5 days, she taught our family so much. Yeah, we learn life is precious, but I'll throw out to you that when you experience what I can only refer to as a giant loss, you realize that big things no longer have the same power over you. Aaron and I were at that point in our careers when Nora died, when we were leaning in, making personal sacrifices to get that next level, get the next promotion. And in a second, the need for that dropped away. I can tell you that life can change in an instant. Everyone knows it, but I know it. So I know that you can have a huge hole open up in your life that can never be filled, but you can continue on, right? So I'm not afraid of losing my job or having to figure out something. I know it can be done. You can fill that. You can't fill the hole, but you can work through it. And the big reason I'm standing here today is because I want to help you know how to handle an event like this. I've shared all the good I've been able to glean from my story, but there's a flip side. The ugly underbelly of people who showed us who they really were. Family members that walked away from us for months, or even we still aren't speaking to after Nora's death. Aaron's brother didn't come to Nora's funeral. He said it was because of a disagreement they had over Aaron's father's care. I'll never be able to this day to put into words how abandoned we felt over that. And we still feel. So if you take something from this sermon, I want you to show up, be there. Yeah, bring the lasagna, but attend the funeral. Aaron reminded me when I was giving him this talk, when Maggie was 3 years old on the 4th of July, we were on vacation, and we got word that a colleague of Aaron's lost his 20-year-old son in a boating accident. Was he Aaron's best friend? No. Did we want to go to the funeral? Yes. Was it hard for us? Hell yes. But we ended our vacation, we packed everything up, and we drove there to hug them and share in their sorrow. It was harder than I expected, but we needed to be there, and it was important. Later on, don't hesitate to talk about the person that died. What's happening? I'm in a deep part here. Okay. All right, talking about them won't remind us of the loss. I'm always feeling the loss. I don't want to talk about Nora, I won't. But sometimes I want to. I want to remember the joy I had in having 3 kids, or talk about how different my life would have been with 3 kids versus 2. Call them to say hi a couple weeks after the death. Take them out to lunch. You don't have to talk about their grief. You could talk about the weather, their kids, their pets. But let them know that they are thought of and are special to you. Because as it says in the video that I showed, the human soul does not want to be advised or fixed or saved. It simply wants to be witnessed exactly as it is. So I'm going to admit that usually when I'm speaking, I'm doing it in a corporate setting. And we love acronyms. So I made us an acronym for this. I want to give you this to carry when you leave. When someone suffers loss, we all need to love. Listen. Listening is the most powerful tool we have in this life, and we don't use it enough. Try to be an active listener. It's an amazing thing when you are hurting to have someone truly listen to you. Openness. Be open to your feelings. We have a range of emotions for a reason, and try to be comfortable letting yourself or others be sad when they're sad. Be present in that space. Visiting. Continue to check in on people dealing with grief after the funeral. They may need a hug, lunch, or a walk outside, maybe a movie. But what they most need is human connection with someone that cares for them. And empathy. Remember to try and take the perspective of the person dealing with the loss. Connect with them, which is, it's hard, because then you need to remember how you felt when something painful happened to you. But try not to judge someone's grief. Empathy is feeling with people. Be willing to get in that hole with the person grieving. Connections make people feel better, not words. In closing, I will tell you that when people say things like, "I don't know how you kept on after Nora died. Well, if I lost a child, I wouldn't be able to get out of bed." But I will tell you, I got out of bed because I was grateful. I'm grateful for my life, all of it. And I can't pick and choose which parts of it to be grateful for, but I can tell you that I'm grateful for the love I have in my life. Love of a devoted spouse, two great children, and a wealth of friends that were there for me and will always be there. Through my suffering and loss, I'm able to have a true human connection with others who I know are also suffering. And I want you to be there for each other, witness each other, listen to each other. Comfort in, dump out. Show love. Blessed be and amen. And now let's take a moment for quiet meditation. Our benediction today is from Gordon McKinnon. Let there be light. Let it shine in dark places, in moments of pain, in time of grief, in the darkness of hatred, violence, oppression, whereas there is discouragement and despair. Wherever darkness is put to light, flight, let there be light.